Last week we covered the details of this of a brief biography of a unnamed man who just referred to in the passage as the man. And the passage introduces this man by saying that he is blessed. And we discussed how the word blessed in this passage, according, and also the other 25, 26 times it's used in the Psalms, it's addressing his joy. It's a reference to his joy. It's addressing the delight that he has. And it's important that the author address that, because the world has a definition of what joy is. And the author of Psalm 1 is trying to introduce you to actual joy. So he's saying, blessed, delightful, joyful is the man who does not, walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the way of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers. In contrast, verse 2 says, but he delights in. I want you to recognize that the word delight in verse 2 is a replica of the statement that he's giving you in verse 1. He's giving you a synonym for the word blessed in verse 1. He's saying that he's blessed because he does not do these things. But verse 2, he lets you know what his delight is actually in. So he does not delight in walking, standing, and sitting among the wicked, the sinners, and the scoffers. Instead, his delight is in the law of the Lord. Now, it's important that we understand what he means by the law of the Lord, because he's not merely referring to the relationship that he has with God. He's referring to the relationship that he has with what God says. And he says that it is a delight to him. It's not merely referring to the relationship he has with God. He's not just talking about how God can function as a tyrannical being over him, or a superior or supreme being over him. He's referring to the language that comes from the mouth of that God and how he has an affection, not just for the person, but for what the person says. The law of the Lord is a delight to him, which speaks to how he feels about this person, but it also goes into the depth. If he does not really know, this is very important, he does not really know things about God. When you delight in what someone says, it speaks to how much you know God. It's not knowing things about him, it's knowing him. It is knowing him. When we were at our previous church, I was a pastor at a church in Aurora/Inglewood, because multi-campus, and but I spent most of my time in Inglewood, and we were, how do I put this? Okay, you know, it's in Cherry Creek, so there were not a whole lot of people in the room who looked like me. Okay, I'm trying to be delicate here. Okay, so a bunch of white people, and then us. Okay, and in fact, there were a few hundred people who came to that campus, about 400 or 500, maybe 600 people, and there were 4 black people in the room every week, and it was 4 black people, because it was me and a man named Pastor Keita. By pastor, I mean on staff, and our wives. That was the 4, okay? So basically, 2 of us were paid to be there, and then 2 of us were there because of covenant. So that was that situation. And then we ended up hiring a worship pastor who did look like us, and he took a liking to my wife's singing. And so my wife got to sing pretty regularly. So I always sat very near the front, and I would do to Cherie what she does to me while I'm preaching. So I was in the, come on, girl, you better do this thing, okay? And I would never really say anything, but while she was singing, there was one particular song that she was singing that messed me up every time she sang it. I would always stand up, and everyone in the room would just kind of go away. Everyone would disappear. I did not notice this was a thing. I did not know it. But everyone would just disappear in the room, and I'm looking at my wife, and I'm just in tears while she's singing the song, okay? You know why? For a few reasons. Because, number one, it was really good. Number two, it was a moment that led us to worship. And also, before we got married, I didn't think she could sing. And then I found out, oh, she can do this. And she can do it well, and it introduces us into the presence of God. It would mess me up every single time. And there was this moment of just this joyful pride that would come up when I would listen to her sing this song. Toward the end of my time there, a young lady sent me an email. She was a high school student. She sent me an email to let me know how complicated things were in her home between her parents. And she said the thing that would, because of that, she had given up on marriage. Okay, and she said, but the thing that redeemed it for her was that when your wife sings, you stand up and you not only delight in her, but you delight in the words that come from her mouth. This was a 17-year-old who wrote this. you would stand up and we could see the joy in what she was saying. And it's not merely the words themselves, but you were blessed because of your affection for the person who was saying it. When he says to you, I delight in the Lord, he's not just talking about the God. He loves him so much that he relishes in every single word that spills forth from the mouth of this God. When presented with the opportunity to walk, stand, and sit among the wicked, the sinners, and the scoffers, when he compares that to the opportunity to bow before a God who is the deep joy for him, and hear the commandments that come forth, the choice is an easy one for him. Now, here's why you should take note of that. Sometimes, what the wicked, the sinners, and the scoffers say appeals to our personality more than what God says. We can all pretend. You're the ones who show up for church when it's hot. And because of that, you are the holy. You are the preborn John the Baptist. I got it. Okay. So you're like, that doesn't apply to us. But if you were to self-assess, you would have to concede that there are times when that which the world offers you is more appealing than what God is offering you. And in that moment, you get a glimpse for just a moment into who or what your actual joy is. It may not be an ongoing thing. I love the way Pastor Derek puts this. He says the life of discipleship is like the Dow average. It's like NASDAQ. It's not a straight trajectory up or down. It's a jagged, some days up, some days down. As long as it's on an upward trajectory, then your display of discipleship is a good one. I think that that's how it is. There are occasions when that average drops a bit, and what the world is saying to you can be more valuable, more delightful, a better display of your joy than what God says to us. But when you think about who's presenting one versus the other, and you compare them, then you should have a response on par with the man in Psalm 1. Because first of all, what the world offers you cannot be assured. How can someone who's dying compared to eternal promises when they cannot be the eternal beings independently? How is that possible? Why wouldn't the God of life be the one whose voice weighs more? Sometimes what the world is offering you is more appealing because the enemy is a student of you and he's making an offering to you to distract you from your affection for the law of God. That sometimes is the plan. How can I distract them from that which God would have them do? The agenda there is for you to be a chess piece on a board so that you can be used in a move to embarrass God. And the fact is, the whole time, God's on the other side of the board calling you to himself. When was the last time you heard both calls and you chose the one that is temporal, broken, sinful, over an affection for a law that comes from the mouth of God himself? If we were to be honest. But Brandon, that's not me. Well, wait a minute. Well, I had a conversation with my son yesterday. We had to go to a civil war broke out in my aquarium. So it was like fish beef in the tank. So one of them just decided, you know what? I want all of this. And just started. So he's just been just gradually just killing everybody. Just killing everybody. This is my spot. And the solution to that is I have to purchase more fish to overpopulate the tank. So now he doesn't have one fish to pick on. It's several fish to distract him. So he's not just killing them one at a time. So we had to go to, I only buy fish from one store in the Denver metro area. And it's off of C-47. It's a long drive. So it was a moment where I could give Sheree a break from the kids. And so they all get in the car with me. And we go for this long drive to this one place in the city where I would buy fish. And we were on the way there, and my son saw four Teslas on the way to this place. And he was in full Tesla mode yesterday, because apparently he did the same thing that morning when they went to go swimming that morning. He was all about this particular car. He says, I saw Toyotas and Teslas all day, Dad, but the Tesla, that's really nice. That's all I saw all day. No one wants a Toyota. He was kind of poo-pooing on Toyotas. He's like, I got to get this Tesla. And then I'm listening to him, and I'm storing up this information from him for the teachable moment that's inevitably going to come because he's seven. And if he talks long enough, you have to have a teachable moment. It's just inevitable. Just wait for that window. And so we're driving back from the pet store. And because of the providence of God, another Tesla drives by. In fact, we're almost home. We're on MLK. And a Tesla driver, he says, there's another one. And he says, I believe that that's the world telling me that that's what I'm supposed to have. There were so many lessons there. Number one, boy, you didn't pay for the pants you have on right now. What makes you think you're gonna buy this car, okay? I'm not buying it for you. I'm pretty sure your mother and I are on the same page on whether we're gonna buy you a car, okay? And by that I mean we're not buying you a car, okay? In fact, when you hit a certain age, that's in the not too distant future, you got to get out of my house, okay? Because the room in which you sleep is not even yours. What are you talking about? The world is telling you that that's the kind of car that you're supposed to have. Now, he didn't realize the definition behind some of the terms he was using. So when he used the word world, I'm thinking about the message I'm preaching today. I heard a seven-year-old talk about how the world is telling him what he should and should not do. And I had to catch myself to make sure that I did not respond to him as though a grown man said something ridiculous to me. I had to remember, he's seven, okay? He's an old six, as a matter of fact, okay? I had to be careful with how I handle this conversation. But then I walked him through this. I said, son, not only can you afford the pants you have on, but when was the last time the world told you to do something that you should not do? Now, here's the problem he had in the car with us. Reese was with us. Evangelist Reese. So before I could even get the plane off the ground, she was in a hurry to land it. No, Ellis, you shouldn't listen to what the world tells you. You should hear what God says. And I was like, hold on, Reese, wait. You're preaching the last chapter, baby. Wait a minute. I got to get him there first. She says, no, I got it, Dad. And then and Jesus and this. And he's the one. I'm like, okay, well, you know what? You brought this on yourself. So I parked the car, went inside, left them in the car while my daughter is sharing the gospel with her brother. I thought about this for a moment, thought how ridiculous it is to hear that come out of the mouth of a seven-year-old. This is what the world is telling me that I should have. But how many 27, 37, 77-year-olds evaluate their worth based on how they have achieved what the world says should be their joy? Versus delighting in the law of Yahweh. Now, does this mean I'm telling you to not have stuff? No. I'm telling you that your stuff should be built upon the law of the Lord. It should not be your Lord. It should be relegated to a display, a life that's lived that displays what the law of the Lord is. Where is your actual joy? Now look how he says this man will look, because you can recognize him. He says, verse 3, he is like a tree planted by the streams of water that yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. Now, here's the thing that I want to rehearse this for you again, okay? We will sometimes look at what the world says is success. We'll sometimes look at what the world say our joy should be, and we will pursue that. By the way, sometimes it's packaged really well. Sometimes it's really well packaged, the education that you get. No one should be opposed to you getting an education. But if your life is defined based on the education that you received and what's hanging on a wall, then you are approaching education from the perspective of the world instead of out of a delight in the law of the Lord. Okay? It's not always a bad thing. The car you have, if being used for divine purposes, is not the same thing as you having the car so that you can say you have this type of car. There's a difference in how you approach even the material things that you have. The businesses that you own and the money that you have should exist in your hand to the glory and renown of God, not so that you can have notoriety and a name in the city where you live. It's a difference in how you approach this thing. And I say that to you because sometimes it's hard for us to choose between those two tensions, because what the world provides for you is provided for you immediately. The world gives you its promise immediately. When you get the wealth, you haven't even bought anything yet. I'm a multi-millionaire. You haven't even bought anything. And the world gives you notoriety based on that immediately. Once you have the car, I don't know what neighborhood you grew up in, it didn't even have to be the sweetest car in the world. There was a guy in my neighborhood who had an Acura Legend. If you're 40, raise your hand. Okay? And it had 20s on it. And that boy got that car entirely the wrong way. I'm not going to get into how he did it, but he was a pharmacist, okay? In a street pharmacist, okay? And he got that car entirely the wrong way. Everyone knew who he was immediately, because the renown, the praise that comes with that accomplishment in my neighborhood, it came immediately. And the passage is telling you that oftentimes the immediate promise may be an indicator that it came from the wrong hand. He says in verse 3, he is like the man is like a tree planted by streams of water. This is very important. That yields its fruit when? In its season. In contrast, he says in verse 4, the wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. So it's this thing where you may get your promise immediately if you pursue this thing from the perspective of the world. But guess what? According to verse 3 and 4, that immediate reward is temporal and it is weak. It is like chaff in the field that will be blown away by the inevitable wind to come. In contrast, the man who seeks the law of the Lord, his promise may come later, but it is enduring. And you can tell which one it is because the man who has the long-suffering, the late received but enduring promise, his strength is on display. He's like a tree, a mighty oak next to the water, never enduring thirst ever again, and putting himself on full display in the presence of the world. It may have taken him a while to achieve that, but once it came, it was a long and enduring promise. The world gives it to you now, but it's temporal. It's dying. It's weak. It's chaff. You get a name, but one wrong move and the world that gave it to you will hate you. Oh, wow. Verse 5, therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the voice of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Now, this one, verses 4 and 5, is what gives me pause as relates to when I compare myself to the man that's described here. Because I notice that the author evaluates enduring from an eternal perspective, not a temporal one. You evaluate something based on what it will be eternally, not temporally. The problem with us is sometimes temporal life can seem long. But you know, one of my favorite phrases from a song is that it's the whole idea of it. It's in one of the subsequent verses in Amazing Grace. We're talking about how worship will be in eternity. And the author says, if I had 10,000 tongues, I would not exhaust them in singing your praise. You're not going to run out of time. No one, I'm looking forward to this day. I don't believe anyone in eternity is watching watches. No one's looking at that. I look at watches. I'm a watch guy. I'm always about, I know you don't believe me. I don't look at watches when I'm preaching. But usually, I'm always paying attention to what time it is. Especially if I'm waiting on someone. Because I have a friend who's from East Africa. And he tells me the problem with America is, in America, you have all the watches in the world, but no time. And he says, in Africa, we have no watches, but we have time. There's this thing where they create margin in their lives so they're able to engage. So if I'm walking to a place and I see a long unseen friend, I can actually stop and engage this person. And when I get to my destination, I can say to them, I saw a friend I had not seen in years, and everyone understands why I got here at 10-ish instead of getting here at 10 o'clock. Now, I'm not giving you permission, because I just know that that's going to come back to bite me later. When you walk in here at 10:30 and say, Brandon, I saw a friend I hadn't seen in days. Hadn't seen him since Thursday, and he's my guy. So I had to get here late. That's not what I'm saying right now. But I'm saying that if you go to global South cultures, the way they approach time is much more in line with a biblical view of time than the way it is in the West. Much more in line, because they treat temporal as what it is, temporal. It's brief to them. It is a brief moment compared to what our eternal perspective will be. And I mention that to you because in verses 5 and 6, verses 1 through 4 don't make any sense unless you have the understanding of time that the author has given you in verses 1 through 4. Because notice what he does when he addresses the understanding of the life that's going to be rewarded versus the life that's going to be destroyed. He says, therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. He's evaluating the life that's lived according to its eternal destination, not its temporal moments. That's how he's evaluating this, which should be scary for us, because that could mean that loving the law of the Lord will not reap a reward until you enter eternity. That's entirely possible. It's not certain, but that's entirely possible. I've used this 3 times in 3 weeks. I think you missed one of them, so that one didn't count. I was talking to a friend of mine who pastors a church in Texas a week ago, and he was giving me a list of books that he fancies himself a book person, and he knows I am too. So he and I were discussing which books each of us have read lately, and we were making book recommendations to one another. And he recommended 2 books, his first 2 on his list, caught my attention right away. And I'm not going to mention the first one because it's ridiculous. But the second one, well, it's a secret. But then the second one, it's ridiculous. The second one was that Joel Osteen book, Your Best Life Now. He had this whole speech. We were on the phone, so he did not hear my facial expression while he was talking about this book. He's like, but living. He talked to me for 5 minutes about living my best life now. Living your best life now. Now, listen to me. I did change how I see this a bit, okay? Because I do believe that I should live the best life I can live now. But the language he was using around that phrase would imply that this is the best I can live now. And so I should pursue this now. And so my response to him was, Doc, if this is as good as it gets, I'm kind of done with God. If this is as good as it gets, I am done with God. And I'm not done with God. But if this is the best we're going to do, okay? And he says, what are you talking about? We live in a season of the world that is better than any previous moment in the history of the world. He said, we have iPhones, and we have the internet, and we have like online banking. I said, man, wait a minute. You're relishing in an iPhone? Do you understand that half the time, based in this building right now, my iPhone does not work? Do you understand it? My previous phone, I had to get rid of it in less than a year because the home button didn't work every time, and I started getting a sore thumb from having to push the button so many times to get it to function after pressing it. In fact, when I got the new phone, I had so trained myself to hit the button 3 or 4 times that with the new phone, it would get confused because I would hit it so many times before I would stop pushing. My thumb just did not, it would just triple tap that thing, and it right away, okay? I said, your whole life, your best life now is defined by a phone. Yeah. A fragile plastic and glass phone. You better not drop it because it's useless after you drop it. If you don't have Apple Care, you are wasting your money. I speak from experience. That if your whole life is defined by this phone, if anything, the thing that's most like God is the Apple Care. The phone is a waste of our time. The internet has been one of the most destructive things. It's one of the greatest, but it's also one of the most destructive things we've ever received. Pornography addiction has gone up exponentially since you did not have to sneak into a building and get a black bag and walk out with it. Since you can do it in the privacy of your home, it has gone through the roof. This thing that you consider the source of our best life now is the internet, and in many regards, it is destroying us. There are things that people will say to me online that they would never in a million years say to me in person. It is a destruction of who we are. We have a false definition of what the word friend means. You want to wound someone? Unfriend them on Facebook. And that's the source of our best life now. Whereas in contrast to that, this author is talking about the eternal outcome of this. And he's saying to us that the life you live now is merely a foretaste of what that best life will be eternally. The long-suffering, enduring outcome of having the law of the Lord as your delight, your joy, fixating on who God is instead of what the stuff is. It gives you this whole different perspective on the stuff that you have. You see it through the lens of the eternal, not the broken temporal. So here's a question. Where does God rank among your joys? Is it that he gets a high position on a day when he blesses you in your timing? Or do you take offense when he shows up in his timing and gives you his display when he wishes for you to have it? I realize how much that part of our theology fell through. And I also look back on how when we were younger, older people who did not go to seminary were bringing this brilliance to us without us even realizing what it is. How many of you have ever heard someone say, he may not come when you want him, but he'll be there right on. Have we ever sung He's an On-Time God? Can we do that, son? The floors are not wood, so that's a whole instrument we lost right there. We lost that instrument. But what about us singing He's an On-Time God? Instead of saying, he's a God who better be here when I appeal to him as though he's my butler and do that which I would have him do. That's not you having joy in him. That's you having joy in his stuff. Who's the actual joy? When he speaks, is it a fragrant aroma for you? Or is it one more rule for you to have to obey? Where does he rank among your joys? Are you the blessed, delighting, joyful man and woman? Okay, so we live in a two-story house. Here are the rules with a two-story house. When I'm downstairs, I don't go upstairs until it's time to be upstairs. And then I go upstairs, and once I'm upstairs, I'm not going back downstairs until tomorrow morning when I must go downstairs. If there were an exit door with a slide from the second floor of my house, I would never go downstairs. I would just ride down the stairs. I shouldn't be saying this in front of Courtney. But I would just ride down a slide to go to my house. It's the quickest and easiest, less exerting route. And everyone knows this. If there's stuff that needs to be upstairs, what do? You put it on at the base of the stairs, and then everyone knows, do not go up the stairs without taking something off this step, because that's how it gradually works its way upstairs. That's how we do it in our house. Do I have a witness? Okay, I better have a witness to that, because either I'm the only brilliant person in the room, because that's how it works. Okay, that's how we do this. Last night, we're not merely upstairs, but everyone's in the bed and the lights are off. Because it's bedtime. Today's Sunday. We're not trying to have people sleep it and wandering around the house like zombies on Sunday morning. You go to sleep because we're getting up and we're going to church tomorrow. That's how that works here. They know that's how it works on Saturday night. I'm in the bed, and let me tell you something. I have been sleepy since 5. And it's about 9:30, 10 o'clock, okay? And then my wife tells me, she says to me, I'm thirsty. We talk about her thirst for about 15, 20 minutes. This thirst, this raging thirst that she has. It's like crossing the Serengeti, thirsty. I need something to drink. And I know what she's doing. And I'm not falling for it. I've been married for 15 years and 3 weeks. I know how this works. So she's talking to me about this raging Sahara thirst of hers and how she feels like there's something lodged in her chest that she's sure will get washed down if the springs of water were to open and she were to get this thing to quench this thirst. All right? And we're going through this whole thing for about 15, 20 minutes. And my response is like, you know, I too know what it is like to be thirsty. I too know what that's like. And then finally, we start playing this game. And she says, Brandon, will you go and get me something to drink? Now here's how I knew she was playing me. It's marital playing, though. You played me as my wife, but let's keep it real. We got witness to keep here. Okay, so I discovered by way of Fitbit how many times I go up and down the steps in my house on a daily basis, how many flights of stairs I cover. Okay, you know what she did? She says, "Did you cover your 10 flights today?" Yeah, touche. I had, so I'm not going to get the water. So when that one didn't work, she says, baby, will you go? By the way, you know it's work a bit because she's not going to get it herself, okay? She says, will you go to get a glass of water for me? I said, how many ounces do you need? And she said, well, my cup is in the refrigerator. It's already ready to go. Just fill it up, put the lid back on it, and bring it back to me. And just go fill it up. It's ready to go. And I'm pretty sure that once I drink that, this tight feeling of thirst that I have in my chest will get washed away, okay? So then I get up and I go down the stairs to get the water. And then I come back. And I didn't show her this because I've been married for a while. But I may have been like, this is messed up, okay? Because she knows I'm in the bed. I'm in burrito. All right, just got the blanket. I'm all wrapped up. I gotta unzip and everything to get out the sink. And I go down and get this water. I come back up the stairs, and then I come in and I hand it to her. And she turns the lights on and she looks at me. And she says, "Thank you. Oh, some water. It's water. Okay. Now the Brandon of old would have, because I had a cup on my nightstand. The Brandon of old would have got that cup and gone into the bathroom and topped that thing off. But in that particular moment. And that's what I would have done for the kids, by the way. But in that particular moment, yeah, please, yes. You brush your teeth in there and drink this water. But in that particular moment, I wanted her to get what she was requesting according to my affection for the one making the request. Are you tracking with that? So I want her to get the good stuff. I'm going downstairs to get the filtered water from the refrigerator. And I made sure it was exactly at 20 ounces, because I'm assuming that this 20 ounces was the magic number to get this sand that was lodged in her chest all the way down to where it's supposed to be. And when I came upstairs, she recognized how entirely sacrificial. It was 11 flights that day instead of 10. And she knew exactly how sacrificial it was for me to go down and get this water. And in that moment, she realized that the thing I was responding to was not the request, but the person and the voice out of which the person came, and it was a display of not only how much I delight in her, but the voice that comes from her when she makes the request. When was the last time God made a request of you, and your response was not a list of reasons why you should not do it, but it was responding to your deep affection for both the person and the voice coming from the person? Or does God have to coerce you into doing that which he would have you do? He has to make the appeal more than once. Or you're Jonah, and you gotta get shipwrecked and get spit up by a fish before you finally respond to the voice. Instead of it being a task, when was the last time it was your joy? When we do our offering here, you will notice a consistent thing that we say is, do not give out of duty. You give out of joy. The New Testament assumption regarding giving is that you give cheerfully. You give out of your joy. We don't want you to say, God, here, take this and leave me alone. We want you to say, it is my overwhelming joy to be of service to you. God does not want your duty. God wants your sacrificial joy. He wants you to delight in the law that comes forth from his mouth. When comparing what he says to the trajectory of the wicked, the scoffers, and the sinners, you see the balanced difference between the two, and you seek him first and foremost. Is he your joy? Or is he the tyrant who reigns over your life, of whom you are embarrassed and you keep your relationship with him a secret because he's not a delight, he's a burden? Let me tell you how you can choose. The one who saw you in desperate need and decided to meet that need to the greatest sacrifice possible. He died so that you could have him. That God has more than earned the right to be your joy. If he never did another thing for you for the rest of your life, he has more than made himself worthy of your joy. My son and I have this thing going on, okay? It's this, he hasn't figured out how this works, because my daughter is a pleaser by nature. So whatever she thinks will bring you happiness, she will do that. And my son is whatever the opposite of pleaser is. I don't, I'm trying to be careful with how I talk about my son, but he does not feel the need to please you. Okay, he never feels that. Some of you know from, if you work in Kid Zone, you know that my son like does it. There was a time when we were at my house, James is here, and James walked up to Ellis and said, "Do you remember my name?" And Ellis looked at him and said, "Just tell me your name." Why are we playing this game? You know your name, just tell me your name. Okay, that's how his mind works. And I can't get at him because I'm pretty sure that genetically he inherited from his father. That he has no need to please you at all. So I will go to my daughter. My daughter has this thing, and I have this thing where I will say, "You're my favorite daughter." And she'll say, "You're my favorite daddy." Okay? Because she knows that's what I'm trying to get. Ellis will not do it. He will not do it. I will say, "You're my favorite son." He'll say, "You're my only daddy." Like, you can't be my favorite daddy if you're the only, I mean, God, I guess if you're the only one, then you're my favorite one, but come on, let's do the math. Theologically, that's not his mind. And he will not let me make it. Cherie, he will not, at bedtime, "You're my favorite son. You're my only daddy. Stop telling me that. I got it." Okay, that's how his mind works, okay? And you know what he's taught me? Making me happy is not his joy. It's not. You know, genuinely, how his mind works is, things being structured and organized properly, that is my joy. I need for things to make sense. You can't be my favorite if you're the only. That's how his mind works. I thought that forever. That that's more important to him than making me happy. But you know what he started doing lately? He will come into our room before they go to bed. He'll climb up onto the bed. And so that his mother and his sister can't hear him violate his laws of logic, he will whisper into my ear, "You're my favorite daddy." Oh. Now, here's what I learned from that. Because I was always his favorite dad. Let's keep it real. You can't suppress that which is your actual joy forever. Inevitably, even if it's in a whisper, it's going to come out. You can't suppress it forever. Every now and then it's going to leak out, which means that you need to have two things going on with you. First of all, the capacity to self-assess, and then godly, loving relationships that are allowed to speak into your life so they can point out what your life is actually displaying as your joy. Because if it's not God, then someone who has affection for you needs to course correct you, turn you back toward the God who is more than worthy of those affections. So in other words, how are you walking? Where do you stand? And how are you? Where are you sitting? And someone should speak into that to tell you how you course correct, to show God who he actually is. Amen.